The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
One of the people that pleaded guilty, Joshua James, described being instructed, in effect, to be prepared to take his guns to the White House and to prevent whoever, the National Guard or whoever might appear, to prevent Trump from being forcibly removed.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, September 26th, 2022. Stuart Rhodes, the chieftain of the Oath Keepers, goes on trial this week for seditious conspiracy. The trial is expected to run about 5 weeks, with jury selection sort of already underway. The opening of the trial gives us a great opportunity to catch up with Roger Parloff on the Oath Keepers, the chief defendant Stuart Rhodes, and the larger project of criminal accountability for the January 6th riot and insurrection. We talked about the ever-mounting statistics of convictions and sentencing in January 6th-related matters. We talked about Stuart Rhodes, who is he? And his weird journey from Yale Law School to conspiracy theorizing and violent uprisings. We talked about the specifics of the indictment, what makes Proud Boys different from Oath Keepers, who was the pointy end of the spear, and who was standing around waiting for the president to invoke the Insurrection Act. And we talked about the law under which this is taking place, the famed seditious conspiracy statute. It's the Lawfare Podcast, September 26th. Roger Parloff keeps his oath. I want to start with just a basic overview of where we are in the January 6th criminal process. People know that there have been 800 some odd cases charged, that a bunch of pleas have happened, that a bunch of misdemeanor cases have been resolved. But what does the big picture look like at this point?
Well, there's 870 cases been brought with federal charges, and almost half are already disposed of, at least in terms of convictions. 390 guilty pleas, another 16 convictions after trial. So maybe 46-47% have been disposed of. We're also beginning to get our first sentences after trial, which are appreciably longer than the guilty plea sentences were, that some people were upset about, although they are still not as long as the government would like them to be. But we're getting somewhere.
Yeah, so let's break that down a little bit. When you say that 360, did you say?
I think there's been 300. I'm using the figures from the George Washington University program on extremism, and they believe there have been 390 guilty pleas already.
Okay, so 390 guilty pleas. What do we know about sentencing in those cases so far?
So a lot of those were misdemeanor cases, so they are light sentences. But the heaviest sentences so far, there were two for 63 months. Those were assaulting a police officer with a dangerous weapon. Mark Ponder and I think Robert Palmer each got 63 months. And I think Joshua Pruitt, who is a Proud Boy but pled guilty, It got 55 months. That was for corrupt obstruction of an official proceeding.
And there have also been a series of cases that have now gone to trial, been tried, and resulted in one case, I think, a partial acquittal, and in some cases, convictions. So what does the landscape of trial look like?
Yeah, we've had 15 completed trials, contested trials, of 17 men. They are all men. 8 by jury, 9 by bench trial. That means a non-jury trial. And in the jury trials, the government has convicted all 8 men on 43 out of 43 counts. In the bench trials, 9 went to trial. There was a complete acquittal on a misdemeanor case. And then we've had convictions on 43 out of 53 counts.
So basically, you want to roll your dice in front of a judge in the District of Columbia. You don't want to mess with D.C. juries if you're a January 6th defendant.
I think that is certainly the message if you drew Judge Trevor McFadden. All of the non-convictions have occurred before him. Now, I'm not criticizing him. I was present for one of those trials, and I would have – the three counts he acquitted on, I would have done the same. But I do think it's true that people draw him because he has said that he feels these cases are being treated more harshly than the Portland riot cases. He's the only judge that feels this way or has expressed this. And he even said at one point that he thought it would be reasonable to possibly give lighter sentences in order to even up the score. So
if you happen to draw Trevor McFadden, you have a reason to say, hey, I don't want to roll my dice with the jury. I'd rather roll the dice with this guy.
I think that's right. And I think that of the 9 completed bench trials, I think that around 7 were before him. And there's 3 pending, I should say.
So what do the, in the cases, the non-misdemeanor cases that have gone to trial, what do these sentences look like? The government's gotten some actually big cases won. What kind of time are they getting?
So it's ranged from 4 years to 10 years. And since there's only about 5 of them, I'll just say 48 months, 60 months, 2 at 87 months, and that's 7 years and a quarter if you can't do it in your head, and 1 at 120 months, that's 10 years. And the government asked for appreciably more in all of the cases. They asked for more, and they actually sought 17 and a half years for one and 15 years for another. So these are less, but they're still very appreciable.
So I'm curious, you're watching this stuff as closely as anybody. Have these sentences been less than you would have expected, about what you would have expected, more than you would have expected? In other words, if you were if you were the government, would you be, you know, they always ask for more than they get, or they often ask for more than they get. Would you be satisfied with these sentences, or do these feel light or heavy to you?
I think they were sensible. I thought one, the Guy Reffitt sentence, who got 87 months, I thought that was a little light. He brought a loaded gun with him to the Capitol, impeded officers, had body armor, and destroyed. It was very, very clear he was there to obstruct the proceeding. He continued afterwards. He destroyed evidence. I thought that was a light sentence. But I can't really second-guess too much more.
So on the whole, then, 15 trials, 390 guilty pleas, a range of sentencing that now, and we're still dealing with the bottom half of the barrel in seriousness. So how do you assess the institutional performance of the criminal justice apparatus 1 year and 3 quarters after January 6th, 2021.
I think it's doing well. I think that even, you know, when I say the sentences, some seemed light and some were below what the government asked. You know, I think what the judges are concerned about is not having a huge gap between the guilty plea sentences and the sentences after trial, so that you aren't being terribly punished for invoking your right to a trial, constitutional right. So, you know, 63 months, like I said, was the longest guilty plea. We've had a couple 87 months, one 120 month, and then one beneath that. So, and then the records, even in the bench trials, it's an extremely good record for the government. So we've had one acquittal, and we had three dismissals, but I think two of them were because the defendant died. So, you know, that's less than one half of 1% of 870 cases. So I think the government and the judges are trying hard and doing well.
So we are now coming up on a period in which many of the more serious cases are headed to trial, assuming they don't plead out on the eve of trial. 400 cases resolved, 470 to go. What is the pig in the python look like? How big is the bump that is about to go through the system?
I think we're also seeing more guilty pleas now of, you know, as the trial approaches, a lot of people plead out. And I mean, that's always true. But even with the serious cases, and people know sort of what they're looking at this point, they can see what people have gotten in similar cases. So I think it's actually, we're seeing more guilty pleas to serious felony cases. Joshua Pruitt was a pretty serious case, these assaults on police officers. We also had five stipulated trials. It's an unusual procedure, but it's basically a guilty plea that lets you appeal one count. But we're finally also going to reach the top charges, the seditious conspiracy charges. That's the next big step.
Right. So that starts kind of now with the trial of Stuart Rhodes, the Oath Keeper in Chief. Talk to us about the Stuart Rhodes case, which, as I understand it, is going to trial this coming week, or sort of going to trial this coming week.
Yes, if depending on how you define coming to trial. The jury selection will begin September 27th. It's actually sort of already begun. The questionnaires have been filled out by the first 150 venire men, potential jury people. They're aiming to start taking evidence and hearing the openings on October 3rd. That will be a trial of five oath keepers charged with seditious conspiracy. The indictment really charges nine, but they didn't have a courtroom big enough, and it's just difficult to try that many people at once. And so the other four will go to trial in late November. That's the schedule. And we've also had three guilty pleas from oath keepers of seditious conspiracy. We should be expecting them to probably testify. And in fact, we had three earlier guilty pleas of oath keepers involved in this conspiracy. So those are at least six people that might testify. Anyway, it's supposed to go 5 weeks, and the top charge is seditious conspiracy, which is a big deal. We don't see that very often.
Yeah, and so let's first talk about the three who have pled guilty here. Because they are cooperating, they have not been sentenced yet, right?
That's right. I would have to refamiliarize myself with their guidelines. They were hefty. Because seditious conspiracy is a maximum 20-year penalty, which is the same as the top charge until now, which was the corrupt obstruction of an official proceeding. But it's actually more serious in the sense that the sentencing guidelines treat them more seriously. The only crime they use as an analogy, they don't have seditious conspiracy in their little table, but the closest thing to it is treason. And so that results in a pretty serious set of sentencing guidelines.
But we don't know at this stage what a Stuart Rhodes, we have no benchmark within the January 6th world to know what Stuart Rhodes is realistically looking at if he's convicted at trial, right?
That's right. Now, you know, if he were convicted of the top charge, other, you know, the government has already asked for 17 and a half years for assaulting a police officer. I would assume they would ask for at least 20. I mean, that's the max. One of his lawyers in a recent filing claimed that the government was trying to put him away for life. And the government pushed back on that and said they've never said that. I just don't know what that lawyer was basing that on. And that lawyer is a very recent entrant to the whole thing.
All right. So we are going to, we'll get into his possible defenses in a little while, but I want to tack back for listeners who don't have instant recall of Stuart Rhodes or the Oath Keepers. He is, of course, shares with our guest today a graduation from the Yale Law School. Why is Stuart Rhodes an important figure in January 6th, and what is he accused of here behind the word seditious conspiracy?
Yeah, he founded the Oath Keepers in 2009. And just to set the stage a little bit, the Oath Keepers, remember, were the group that all wore sort of militia-like costumes, military-style costumes. And there were two stacks, they call them, people that walked up the East Capitol steps, each with their arm on the shoulder of the person in front of them, in a very disciplined military way, went up the steps. They were very recognizable and very menacing looking. I would distinguish them from the Proud Boys, who their top people are also charged with seditious conspiracy. The Proud Boys were really sort of at crucial places, at crucial times in penetrating the barriers for the first time, breaking the window for the first time, really breaching.
They were the pointy end of the spear.
Yes, exactly. So that's not really true of the Oath Keepers. Now, the Oath Keepers' rhetoric was much, much worse than the Proud Boys, going back to November 2020, very publicly talking about, you know, preventing Biden from taking office, talking in frightening ways about civil war, bloody civil war, sometimes publicly. But still, they were not the group that breached the Capitol. They sort of held back, and only after it was breached, it was then that they marched up the steps. So it's a little different fact pattern.
On the other hand, they did hoard a large amount of weapons at a Comfort Inn in Virginia. They did seem to be gearing up for some kind of civil war. Sketch out for us what the government's case is likely to look like.
Yeah. So they begin talking in a very menacing way about that Trump ought to invoke the Insurrection Act, and he needs to call them up as sort of the militia and help prevent Biden from taking power. This Chinese communist puppet is Rhodes is always calling Biden, both publicly and privately. And he has, eventually they have a signal chat system, which is an encrypted system where there are several channels, actually, where the Oath Keepers talk among themselves. And the most dramatic thing that they do, as you said, is they actually store several quick reaction forces across the Potomac River in Virginia, where they stockpile weapons. One is in a Comfort Inn in Arlington, about, really only 10, 15 minutes from the Capitol, with good traffic. And they also have weapons at Hilton Garden Inn in a little further out in Vienna, Virginia, maybe 40 minutes. And so that's a pretty serious looking thing. They do have a defense planned for that, which I can discuss if you would like.
Yeah, so I'm going to come to the defense momentarily. I guess before we get there, I want to flesh out, you're making this sound a little bit anodyne, actually. They had some nasty rhetoric, but they're not the pointy end of the spear in the riot, and they're hoarding weapons, but the weapons are legal in Virginia. That's why you have weapons in Virginia. That's what Virginia is for. It's the place to store your weapons so you don't bring them into the District of Columbia. Why is this charged as a seditious conspiracy case rather than as, guys got violent in objecting to the, what distinguishes this case from the average group of guys who marched up in military formation into the Capitol?
They're going to present evidence that they had decided that regardless of what Trump did, they were going to stop Biden from taking office. And the evidence against certainly Rhodes, and I don't know how many others, will be that even after January 6th, they continued to stockpile weapons. And, of course, at this point, Trump has not invoked the Insurrection Act and continue to plot to prevent Biden from taking office. And there is one of the people that pleaded guilty, Joshua James, described being instructed, and I don't have the language in front of me, but in effect, to be prepared to take his guns to the White House and to prevent whoever, the National Guard or whoever might appear, to prevent Trump from being forcibly removed.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Could your political views make you the target of cybercrime, identity theft, stalking, or even violence? I used to think this was silly, and then weird things started happening to me. Someone defaced my car. It had Lawfare license plates on it. Somebody delivered weird antique postcards of Guantanamo Bay to my house. Weird stuff. The volume of personal data online has tripled between 2019 and 2023. And angry individuals fueled by political polarization can access it all for up to 98% of American citizens. And I was one of them. Lots of people were using my name, my home address, other information about me to try to intimidate me. And I want to say that has dramatically slowed down in recent months. And one of the reasons is Delete Me. As I have said before, there are products here that I read the ads because, that's my job. And there are products here that I read the ads because I really use them and really like them. And Delete Me is one of the Lawfare advertisers that I am most enthusiastic about. And here's why. It finds and removes personal information I don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from all of the largest search databases on the web, and in the process, it helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. And here's the important point. It doesn't just do it once, because the information will get back into the systems. It does it, and then it does it again. So the first time I got one of these reports, and they send regular reports at Delete Me, you know, there were a whole bunch of systems that I'd come off of. But then each time I get one now, there's still one or two or three that I'm back on the system and Delete Me has once again deleted me. So sign up and provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted, and their experts will take it from there. And as I say, they send regular personalized privacy reports showing what info they have found, where they found it, and what they removed. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. When you sign up, they immediately go to work scrubbing all your personal information from data broker platforms. Your personal profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for Lawfare listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use the promo code Lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code Lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code Lawfare20. So is it fair to say that the Oath Keepers at the end of the day engaged in less violent activity than the Proud Boys, but may have plotted more violent activities? So it's more the conspiracy part of the seditious conspiracy, maybe a little bit less of the seditious part of the seditious conspiracy, though both have both.
That's right. That's a good way to put it. The rhetoric was more extreme with the Oath Keepers. And I think the stockpiling of weapons both before and after was more dramatic. I mean, I think they say $17,000 worth of weapons and ammunition and sort of other things, scopes and mounts and all of that before, and then another maybe $6,000, $10,000 after. But no, they do not. Only one or two are charged with assaulting police officers or impeding officers even. They're mainly charged with obstructing the proceeding and destroying evidence afterwards, sort of conventional obstruction of justice.
All right. So what is the defense of Stuart Rhodes going to look like? You alluded to some new entrants into the field of the defense, the Stuart Rhodes and Oath Keeper defense bar. What arguments do they have? Why on earth are they letting this go to trial?
So they have a couple interesting things. With respect to those QRFs, the quick reaction forces, what they're going to argue is that they anticipated or hoped that President Trump would invoke the Insurrection Act.
And just pause here and remind listeners what the Insurrection Act is. Yep. And what basis they had to expect that Trump might invoke it.
Yeah, well, the Insurrection Act enables the president under certain circumstances to send, you know, National Guard forces to, for instance, a state that has requested them, that's battling with maybe rioting or looting in the wake of a hurricane, or there might be an insurrection, there have been race riots. They were sent to Los Angeles after the Rodney King verdict triggered rioting. I think that's the last time it's been used. Been used maybe 30 times in the U.S. history. But there isn't a lot of case law about it. And also, it's usually they send, you know, National Guard troops. They don't call up, you know,
irregulars.
Irregulars. And in addition, it's usually to quell riots, not to start them. It's, you know, here the claim was that, well, they had stolen, Biden had stolen the election, and they needed to call in. There are different ways to express this, to express it. Maybe Antifa would attack on January 6th and they would need the troops to repel them. But it really sounds like, of course, they were going to use the troops to overturn the election, which is not the typical use for the Insurrection Act. The trouble is that historically, it's not been used often, and you have these 19th century Supreme Court rulings that seem to give sort of unfettered discretion to the president. They don't really, they haven't second-guessed him. No president has used it in order to try to stay in power despite an election. So no one really knows the legal status of all of this. But anyway, so they're going to say they were waiting to be called up as an, you know, unorganized militia, and that's what these weapons were. And so it wasn't a conspiracy to break the law. The prosecution's response will be, I think, twofold. One is they apparently have evidence that Rhodes said from time to time that the whole Insurrection Act thing was a, quote, legal cover, that it was basically a ruse and that they were going to prevent Biden from taking power, whatever it took, no matter what Trump did. So that's sort of the prosecution response, number one. And then the other is that, of course, Trump didn't invoke it, and they entered the Capitol anyway. And they're apparently going to present evidence. They do claim that at least some of the people in the stack were trying to kidnap or, you know, find Pelosi and other congressmen. I'm not sure what their evidence will be there. And then, of course, that the plot continues even after January 6th to try to prevent the inauguration from taking place.
Okay. But I have a sort of antecedent legal question here, which is, assume you didn't have that stuff, right? The stuff that undermines the factual basis of this claim. Is it plausible to say, no, I wasn't there trying to prevent the obstruct the government from certifying the election? I was there. I cached my weapons in Virginia where they were legal. I fully expected Donald Trump to call me up as a sort of irregular member of the militia to calm things down or whatever happened, whatever it was they were expecting him to do. And, you know, I just, you know, was there waiting for the Insurrection Act to be, oh, yeah, I may have gotten caught up a little bit in the some mayhem once it got started, but that's not why I was there. So there's no real conspiracy here. There's just a conspiracy to follow the Insurrection Act when invoked that kind of went a little awry.
Yeah.
Is that a viable defense? Will the judge even allow that defense to be made?
It sounds like he is going to, and it sounds to me Judge Maeda, I think, would have preferred not to. I think he thought that maybe the law would be so open and shut that these people weren't entitled. You know, there is no such thing as an unorganized militia. He thought it would be more clear-cut and that the prosecution would say, no, keep this evidence out. The prosecution didn't say that.
Because they're waiting for, you know, armed Joe Biden fans to show up so he can invoke the Insurrection Act.
I think that they may feel that their evidence is strong enough that on the facts that this defense just doesn't fly. They don't have to sort of get into what did the Supreme Court rule in 1827 and 1849 on this question. And also, it's that there's evidence that they want to present of, you know, all of the weird plotting going on, all of the violent threats about the bloody civil war coming. Because often what Rhodes would say was, Trump better invoke the Insurrection Act, otherwise there will be a bloody civil war. So the jury is going to hear this term. And they're going to have it defined one way or the other. And I think they must have felt that they actually gave Maida mixed signals, but they felt that they did not ask him to preclude this sort of argument altogether. Maida was concerned, though, because it sounds a lot like there's such a thing as a public authority defense or a entrapment by estoppel. This is what Bannon tried to use, what Navarro is still trying to use. And it's in an anticipatory version. It's not that Trump didn't tell me I could do this, but we were preparing in case he did. And that's something that hasn't ever been used before, an anticipatory public authority defense. And so there was some thought that maybe Maida should not permit this in at all. But in the end, the prosecution didn't really ask for that, and so Maida didn't try to do that on his own.
So how many people are going to trial with Rhodes, and how many other Oath Keepers are there awaiting trial?
This trial will involve five people, including Rhodes. There will be four more that are charged with seditious conspiracy. And then there, I don't have the exact number, there's approximately 11 more that are charged with conspiracy, but not seditious conspiracy.
And what about the Proud Boys? When should we expect them to go to trial?
I think their trial begins, the first one begins in December. There are several different conspiracy trials there, but the only seditious conspiracy trial involves five people, and I believe it goes to trial in December. I should say I am really hoping that the January 6th committee, the House Select Committee, does not bring up the Oath Keepers on September 28th at their hearing, does not bring up the Proud Boys, because they will be handing them another issue on appeal, especially the Oath Keepers. You know, to do this during jury selection would be crazy. So we have to see what happens there.
Yeah, and just walk us through that. Why does it matter for purposes of their trial what Liz Cheney says at a congressional hearing?
Yeah, they have all been trying to get both continuances and venue transfers outside of Washington because of the alleged prejudice to the jury pool from the January 6th hearings. And, of course, those hearings are televised nationally. It's not that strong an argument. But there was a case out of Boston, an appellate ruling in the 50s, where a guy went to trial very shortly after there was a congressional hearing about him and his case. And the First Circuit, the Court of Appeals up in Boston, did overturn that conviction, felt that he should have gotten either more of a continuance or a venue transfer.
So I am unaware of a seditious conspiracy case that has been successful since the Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman case in the 90s. The statute has a long and weird history, and it has, by its terms, is super broad. So tell us a little bit about the history of the case, particularly as pertains to attacks on the Capitol. How does this case fit into that?
The seditious conspiracy statute begins with the Civil War. It's enacted very shortly after the Civil War starts. And the problem was that the key statute they had for prosecuting rebellion was treason. And treason under the Constitution has some strict limitations in terms of proof. And so they enacted this originally in 1861. There was a reenactment in 1871 as part of the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871. And that's the main statute that we're using here. The key language goes like this. If two or more persons in any state or territory, blah, 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 conspire to overthrow, put down, or to destroy by force the government of the United States, or to levy war against them, or to oppose by force the authority thereof, or by force to prevent, hinder, or delay the execution of any law of the United States, they shall each be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 20 years or both. So the key passage for us and for the oath keepers is the or by force to prevent, hinder, or delay the execution of any law of the United States. And then the key laws they're talking about are the laws relating to the lawful transfer of presidential power, specifically the 12th and 20th Amendments and the Electoral Count Act. So that's how we get here. The Rahman case, I think they were using the levying war provision, and some of the other cases. Now, actually, they recently, when they in June, when they superseded the indictment or tweaked it, they added also the to oppose by force the authority of the United States. So they're apparently trying two different provisions of that law.
The law is, despite being broad and apparently very powerful, very seldom used and has sometimes been hard to get convictions under. What is the distinction in your judgment that the government is making between cases it is merely indicting as conspiracy, cases that it's indicting as sometimes misdemeanor forced entry into, you know, basically trespassing cases, and these seditious conspiracy cases? Is there a hallmark of – the hallmark isn't violence, because there are a lot of nonviolent – there are a lot of violent cases that are being indicted as assaulting a police officer and, you know, blocking the functioning of government cases, right? So what is, in your view, the – distinction that the charging distinction that the government is making between the cases that it is and isn't indicting as seditious conspiracy?
There actually aren't that many true conspiracy cases among the 870 being brought. You know, a lot of people read online that about what was happening, and they did expect it to be violent, and they bought their body armor and they and some weapons and. They came, and they did it, plan to stop the proceeding, at least delay it. But I think here you have months and months of planning in a very disciplined and organized way, encrypted messaging. You have a military-style hierarchy. You have military weapons. You have military uniforms. And a concerted and actually an ideology and a concerted effort to prevent the transfer of presidential power. It's really of a different order than what we've seen the other cases.
One final question, and then we'll wrap. Was Stuart Rhodes radicalized by Yale Law School?
I don't know exactly what happened to him. I don't know him. he graduated in 2004. He was disbarred by 2015. People that have described his conduct in law school, it sounds like he was already fairly out there. He was a strong libertarian and worked for Ron Paul for a while. But he founded this group in 2009, the Oath Keepers, and by then it was really a highly paranoid and bizarre group. You know, they were foreseeing that Barack Obama might be. You take an oath, you know, to not do certain things if the government. That's why you're an Oath Keeper. If the government orders you to. And some of the things that they were anticipating was that, you know, the government might blockade cities and turn them into vast concentration camps, you know, so you take an oath to fight against, you know, if Barack Obama tries to do that, you won't permit him. And actually, the things that might come in this case include a lot of sort of QAnon type stuff about he wants Trump to declassify a great deal of information that he believes will show all of the pedophile, expose all the pedophiles in office, all the pedophiles in Congress. It's really out there.
We're going to leave it there. Roger Parloff, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer is the long-suffering Kara Schillen of Goat Rodeo. Hey, folks, you know I mention this every time, but some of you still haven't become material supporters of Lawfare. And if you're one of those people, I am right now pointing a finger at you in an accusatory fashion. You are freeloading. You should be supporting this site if you're listening to this podcast regularly. So remedy this matter immediately at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Make an honest person of yourself. Contribute. The Lawfare Podcast is edited by the one and only Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan, who is still in quarantine in a hotel in China. And as always, thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.